This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books and National Security, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm John Sakellariadis, the host of the channel. For today's show, we are pleased to have Dr. Herb Lin. Dr. Lin is Senior Research Scholar at the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford University and a Hank J. Holland Fellow in Cyber Policy and Security at Stanford's Hoover Institution. In addition to his academic work, Dr. Lin has extensive experience in or around the U.S. government. He is the Chief Scientist Emeritus for the Computer Science and Telecommunications Board within the National Research Council of the National Academies. Prior to that, he served on President Obama's Commission on Enhancing National Cybersecurity. Dr. Lin is here with us today to talk about his new book, Cyber Threats and Nuclear Weapons. Dr. Lin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start simple. What is the book about, and why did you choose to write it now?
Well, the book is about the one aspect of the U.S. nuclear enterprise, which I'll define in a minute, and the fact that every aspect of it is deeply intertwined with the correct and proper operation of computers and information technology. And this dependence on computers creates a whole bunch of risks, some of them that the Department of Defense understands, and I think others which the Department of Defense does not understand very well. I wanted to do this book, and I pushed a shorter timeline for the book because the Biden administration is at present doing what every new administration does, undertaking a review of U.S. Philosophy, if you will, on how it should obtain, configure, operate, etc., its nuclear weapons. And I wanted the book to come out in time to perhaps have some influence on that review.
Now, before we discuss the current or future cyber threats, I want to talk about the affirmative missions that the U.S. nuclear enterprise needs to meet and how computers, networks, and big data support that. Can you sketch the nuclear mission set for us? And now might actually be a good time, too, to talk about what you mean when you say U.S. nuclear enterprise.
Okay. So the U.S. nuclear enterprise, it's a clumsy term, and I don't particularly like it. But I needed a word to stand for every part of the U.S. government apparatus that has anything to do with nuclear weapons. So this ranges from the nuclear weapons themselves, the things that actually go boom, to the it also includes the systems that we use to deliver nuclear weapons from U.S. soil to a target, It has to do with the systems that we plan, that we use to plan the missions, plan what we're going to do. It has to do with the array of systems that are used to order these nuclear systems into operation, what you typically call command and control. It also has to do with the early warning systems, the systems that we have in place to determine if and when an attack and a nuclear attack is coming in on the United States or its allies, and to providing some kind of understanding of the scope and nature of that attack. And it also addresses, to some extent, the command and control arrangements at the top. That is, who's authorized to use nuclear weapons and under what circumstances, and so on. And so all those issues are folded into the report. It is primarily a report about the U.S. nuclear enterprise, as opposed to the Russian nuclear enterprise or the Indian nuclear enterprise. But there may be lessons in that for that. Nevertheless, that's not a primary focus of the book.
So you offer a series of observations and then a number of policy imperatives that flow from those observations. Can you summarize kind of your major findings from your research and what the implications are for policymakers, decision makers, et cetera?
Sure. I think that one of the major implications of this, one of the major findings in this observation is that the nuclear issue, that the cyber issue goes way, 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 way beyond nuclear command and control. I emphasize that because people who have looked at cyber, quote, cyber, unquote, and nuclear have mostly focused on the command and control side of the house, which is the most natural place for it to be. Now, I, of course, spend a fair amount of time in the book on nuclear command and control, and that to me is it is the most obvious and reasonably the most central part of where computers interact with nuclear command and control. But it's not the only place, and I think that's not the only place is often lost. So, for example, you need to have computers are a part of the nuclear delivery systems of the airplanes and the submarines and the missiles and so on. That's a big deal. And if you ignore that, if you don't pay attention to that, then you're missing an essential part of the problem. And so the point is that the vulnerabilities to adversary hacking is not just on the nuclear command and control. So that's that's an important point. The second point is that as we are moving forward in our nuclear modernization program, which there's we're going to spend hundreds of billions of dollars on nuclear modernization, and if according to current plans, if everything goes the way they say it will, and so we're not only buying new hardware, we're figuring out new ways of using the hardware, ways that we haven't used before. And a big deal in the way in which we have been, in which we're planning to use them in the future, is to integrate conventional and nuclear functions. In the jargon, it's called conventional nuclear integration, the integration of conventional and nuclear operations, which means that we're going to be deploying systems that have both conventional and nuclear functions. And my claim in the book, and I think I can defend it well, is that this increases the risk of inadvertent nuclear escalation, which to me is a terrifying thing. It's bad enough to think that we might deliberately go to nuclear war. That is actually stated U.S. policy, that we would reserve the right to use nuclear weapons under certain extreme circumstances, even if the other guy hasn't yet used them. That, as I say, that is stated U.S. policy. That's bad enough, okay? But nobody on our side and nobody on their side whoever the there is, the they is, wants to go to nuclear, you know, wants to go to nuclear conflict inadvertently or accidentally. That is, as a result of misunderstanding or some random accident. And yet we are going to be configuring our systems in a way that raises that risk. So that's the second major observation. The third is that something that everybody knows, is this is not a new insight, but it's included here for completeness, because it really is an important point, that short timelines for decision making increases cyber risk, just like it increases other kinds of misjudgments and so on. Why does it raise cyber risk? Well, if you've ever tried to figure out, if you've ever been in the situation where you have to get your slides working in the next minute and a half because you have a presentation to do, And for some reason, your slides aren't displaying, and you're just looking at the computer system and saying, what the hell is going on with this guy? And you're trying this, that, and the other thing, you know, frantically and so on, to try to get your system up before before the camera comes on. I mean, you understand what it means. Short timelines compress, a short timeline doesn't give you time to figure out what's going on, okay? And it means that you can't fix a problem. And we all know that in various ways computers can fail. And you have to figure out what's going on. Just yesterday, I was in a conference with people at the Department of Defense. And this was a part of the Department of Defense that was dealing, you know, with some cyber and nuclear issues. We couldn't get video on their side. Okay. And it was eventually in time for the meeting to start. And in fact, we never got video working. Now, there's some fix for it somewhere. Somebody needs to, you know, we weren't under attack, but it's that somewhere there was a switch that somebody hadn't clicked on or something like that, but nobody knew what it was. It took a lot of time to figure out what was going on, and it would have taken, and we didn't have time. So we just said to hell with it. Okay. So that kind of thing is, you know, happens all the time. And so if you have shorter time, if you design your systems so that you've configured your nuclear system so that they require a short timeline to decide, you're going to increase cyber risk. Okay. The next one is that, you know, this is a good observation. You know, there is a nuclear command and control system. There's a command and control system right now. And it's, you know, it's a legacy system. It's basically left over from 1985, the same architecture. That was a very long time ago, you know, before the internet and so on. But I'll make one observation about it that nobody will dispute. It has not failed catastrophically since then. It didn't fail catastrophically before then either, okay? But it hasn't failed. And that is a big deal, right? So that means, what it means is that we've had a number of near misses, close calls, but, you know, we've developed procedures and processes that have made it pretty robust, and that is a pretty good track record. And that, you know, have there been problems? Sure, but we have not got up in a puff of smoke, and so that is a good thing. And so that has operational imperatives. It has certain lessons. The fifth observation is that keeping up. People have talked about we're entering a rapidly changing security environment, which is true. Okay, you look around, lots of things are happening very quickly. Okay, and you want to keep up with it. You want your systems, your architectures of command and control, whatever, to keep up with that, but. The more you change stuff, you always introduce the possibility of additional security bugs and problems. And there's a tension between rapidly changing your systems and maintaining an adequate cybersecurity posture. And you cannot resolve that tension. You can't do security if you're rapidly changing your configurations all the time. You just can't do it. Okay. You can't optimize for both. You have to manage that tension. You have to say, well, sometimes here we're going to have to give up a little bit on security, and sometimes here we're going to have to give up on our requirements. And you have to be realistic about that. And the last point is that there are always going to be weak points in the enterprise posture taken over the entire enterprise. Some elements are going to have weaker cybersecurity than others, and those are going to be the ones that the adversary is going to be more likely to cause troubles in. The lesson for that is that everybody, since you don't know where those weak points are, everybody has to be proceed under the assumption that they've already been penetrated, and configure and operate their systems that way. That's a pain in the ass to do, but it's necessary. Anyway, so those are the observations.
At this point, so there are some policy imperatives that flow from the observations, as I alluded to earlier. But at this point, I think at the very least, for the purpose of giving you some time to catch your breath, I want to follow up and draw you out on some of the ideas you just talked about. So one of the fascinating aspects of this book, or indeed this topic in general, is thinking through the marriage of these two things that are suffused with irresolvable trade-offs. You have the always-never dilemma on the nuclear side of the house, and then the security, efficiency, usability trade-off on the computing side. Can you talk a little bit about the state of our thinking on those two issues and perhaps how you began to think about them and their interaction differently over the course of writing this book and conducting this research?
Well, the dilemmas that you just described are not new. There's another one that I would point you to as well, which is the dilemma of wanting more functionality as a trade-off against and that having to trade off against security issues. So I'm going to address all three of them, if you don't mind. On the always never has been recognized by nuclear by people in nuclear policy for a very, very long time. It's a tension that goes way back. The always never dilemma is the following. You never, ever, if you have nuclear weapons, you never, ever, 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 ever want them to be used without proper authorization, right? You don't want something happening by some person or some by accident or something, some nuclear weapon going off when you didn't properly authorize that to happen. And the authority to use, to order a nuclear detonation is reserved for the president. So you never want a nuclear weapon to go off if not without proper orders from the president. That's the never. On the other hand, the always part is you always want them to be able to be used when the president does order them to. Now, this is, you know, this is controversial, especially if you imagine the possibility of a president gone mad, and there have been concerns about that over the years. It happened, for example, with a similar concern. The concern over that happened in 1972, but there are all kinds of scenarios in which you could imagine that the chain of command to order order and actually use nuclear weapons doesn't get, you know, is broken somewhere, and the weapons aren't used when the president said they should be used. Okay, so that's the dilemma, and you'll notice that is, you know, it's impossible to create a system in which you can always get, you know, in which both of those requirements are guaranteed to be fulfilled. Right. And that is an unavoidable tension. Now, it turns out that for entirely understandable reasons, the military side of the house wants always to be able to fulfill its mission if it's been given proper orders. So that means they try to emphasize the always part. We always want to be able to use nuclear weapons when we've been ordered to do so. That's their job, right? I don't criticize them for that. That is their job. That's what they're supposed to be doing. Okay. Civilians, on the other hand, make the observation that they're mostly at peace, right? Mostly we're not in a position where we have to think about using nuclear weapons. And so we want our systems to never function without proper authorization. That's mostly, and so they want to optimize for that. And that's a tension that you can't avoid. The second tension that you're talking about is the usability versus security dilemma, and that is easily illustrated by the fact that you and I and everybody else listening to this has seen at least once in our lives a door that says, "Do not prop this door open, emergency use only," or something like that, and it's propped open with a brick, right? You have seen that. I have seen that. We've all seen those things where some security regulation, safety regulation, has been circumvented in favor of greater convenience. And I quote a story in the book about this very phenomenon happening at a security conference. Okay? So these are not unusual happenings. Everybody in security understands them. Okay? You know that one of the best ways to compromise passwords is to go around looking at people's desks and looking at all the post-its that people have about what their passwords are. But why do people write down their passwords? Because the advice that they get, and the systems impose this on them, they say, make your password complicated and change it often. Okay, who can remember that? Okay, so they write it down. And now you have another compromise. You have another potential compromise. So there are all kinds of issues like that, where security and usability are in conflict. And if you think about it, it's supposed to be that way, right? The whole point of security is to make your system totally unusable to the bad guy, right? But if security does its job, it lets you in whenever you want. So you have to, the security has to distinguish perfectly between a bad guy and a good guy. And of course, one, it can't do that. And two, even sometimes the good guy and the bad guy are the same person, as would be the case if I had an insider that went rogue, right? If you have authorized access to a computer and I bribe you, now you're working for me. Okay, so you know, do you count as a good guy or a bad guy under those circumstances? No way the computer system will know that you've taken a bribe. So you know, there's that tension, and then the third tension, which you hadn't mentioned, but which is really important here, is that there's a constant tension between functionality and security. Now, what do I mean by that? We have a track record of 40 years of computers. Our computers are much, 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 much more useful than they were 40 years ago. That's good, right? Your computer, compared to the ones that you had three generations ago, is faster, it's more convenient, it does more things, and so on. But guess what? It also requires more complex systems. So the operating system that you're running now is bigger than the one that you were running three generations ago, significantly bigger. Why? Because it has to do more. You have more complicated applications. They have to do more. They provide more functionality. They're easier to use. They're faster, whatever. Okay. But every computer person in security will tell you that the enemy of security is complexity. That is, the more complex your system, the more you expect it to do, the less secure it is. So we are in a situation where our demands, our appetite for more functionality is getting in the way. And that's why we're always behind the eight ball on security. We always want more, and therefore we deploy systems that give us more, but they also give us less security. And that's fundamentally why we're behind the eight ball on it. And that's tension that we don't know how to resolve either. Because if you really unpack what I just said, you'll see that it sounds like I'm against innovation, right? Because who doesn't want more functionality? Who doesn't want innovation, right? Everybody wants innovation. Me too. But is it worth the security cost? That's a dilemma that we have never figured out how to address. And that's the problem that I have with that particular trade-off. We don't know how to have a structured, disciplined conversation that says, well, you may get certain benefits from this innovation, but you can't have them because it'll increase the security risks. We don't have that conversation. We don't know how to have that, and there's no way that we know of no successful way that we know of how to manage that systematically. So that's the third trade-off.
At a few different points in the book, you talk about cybersecurity and the nuclear enterprise as being an emergent property of the system, which I think gets to the point you were just making. But can you explain what you mean by that? Perhaps at a simpler level, just talk about how the future nuclear enterprise is going to differ from the existing nuclear enterprise. Obviously, the future one is going to be shaped by, architectural policy decisions that are in the process of being made or are yet to be made. But to the extent we can kind of hold some of that constant and just think about what, computing integration in general is going to mean for the nuclear enterprise and how it might look differently from kind of the current, more hardwired system.
Well, I mean, there's always going to be hard wires. Okay, so one of the differences between the old system and the new system is the old system emphasizes point-to-point solutions. Okay, so if you want to part, A to communicate with B, what you'd have to do is you design a system that would enable A to communicate with B. And if A already was communicating with C, it didn't matter, and so on. And so now the guy at A has to deal with two separate systems. Okay. And so now what you're trying to do is you're trying to integrate all this onto one system that if you want to communicate from A to B, then you set up that you have a network and you plug in A and you plug in B and now they can talk to each other. And now if you want to add C to the mix, you just plug in C and then A can talk to both B and C at the same time. And so this is you can see how doing it this way might give you a greater degree of integration. And in fact, you could get simplicity, some kind of architectural simplicity of that. On the other hand, it now means that a compromise in B might affect C. Why? Because it can communicate through A, and they're also on the same network, so maybe B and C can directly communicate with each other. Okay, so now you've introduced a potential security bug. Okay, and so you have benefited from the fact that you've simplified the architecture, and people find it easier to use, and so on, and they're liable to make fewer mistakes, and so on, and all those are good things. But you now introduce other communications paths that will enable bad things to propagate more than you would have been possible had you been in a point-to-point configuration. I'm not trying to make the argument that a point-to-point configuration is always bad. I'm saying that there are risks that come with this kind of integration that you have to take into account. And maybe the risk is too high. So that I think that so when I say emergent, I mean there's a sense in which I mean it technically. That is, if you set up many risks occur not because of security flaws in the components themselves, but because of the way these are arranged to work together, and a different arrangement would entail different risks. And these are things that you can't really predict, because they have to do with how the system is configured and the decisions that are made by the operator. It's not a technical problem in the sense that you can't just give it to the to the technical wizards at the vendor, you know, at the contractor, how the operation of the system is structured and so on, which is something that's beyond the vendor, matters a lot for security too. And then there's the fact that technology never operates in a vacuum. That is, it operates in an organization with its own, which gives people incentives to do various things. It has its own controls on it and so on. So for example, you've probably had this experience yourself where you're working on a quote secure network and so on, and you want to take some files home that you can work on. So rather than getting authorization to move your files to your home computer and so on, which takes 3 days and a lot of paperwork, you just copy your files onto a USB drive and take them home, or you email them to yourself, and you just bypass the entire system. Now, of course, you could set it up so that it makes it very inconvenient to do that, but then you'll find another way to circumvent the system. So that's what I meant by emergent.
So let's start moving into the threat picture a little bit more. At least within the United States, there are no public documented instances, at least that I'm aware of near-miss kind of existential scenarios, at least stemming from adversary targeting of NC3 infrastructure. But as you point out in the book, there's kind of a wealth of non-adversarial near-miss moments that history offers that can kind of lubricate the imagination and help us sketch possible vectors of cyber-modulated nuclear risk. Can you talk about some of those examples and explain what they tell us about future cyber risk to the nuclear enterprise?
Well, so there was at least one incident which former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry has talked about a lot, in which he was woken up in the middle of the night by a general at NORAD saying, you know, sir, there are there are 200 Russian missiles, the Soviet missiles, heading towards us. And he, you know, and the way he says it is, it was 3 a.m, but that woke him up. and he said, but the general said, no, I know it's a mistake. It's a problem. I've already determined that it's a mistake. But what I want to know is, why the hell did this happen? And how am I going to explain it to anybody in the morning? Okay, that's why he got the call. And he was the only person that he could reach at the time. This is in this particular case. Perry received a warning that it was a training exercise was accidentally run on a real computer which sent exercise information to operational displays around the country. It was just a mistake. Okay, and the system had not been designed to prevent that kind of mistake. And that is a but it took them a little while to figure that out. They figured out it was a mistake pretty quickly, and they never woke up the president. On the other hand, the system, bad things could have happened at that point. A year later, we're right about this. We found that some radars had indicated a large scale Soviet attack, and there was turned out to be a malfunctioning chip that was inserting instead of zero in the number of missiles that are attacking the U.S. It put in twos. For the zeros. So these are instances in which you could imagine that a glitch in this would caused a problem. Now I have to point out that this is really important. The Russians have no interest at all in causing these kinds of problems, right? It does not do the Russians any good to make the U.S. think it's under Russian attack when it isn't, right? That's a clearly stupid thing to do, and nobody on the Russian side would do that, right? That just doesn't make any sense at all, right? Because why would they want to provoke a nuclear attack by mistake and the nuclear attack would go on them, right? They would be against them. That doesn't make any sense at all. On the other hand, you could imagine that one of these things might happen by mistake, as the side effect of some other Russian operation inside U.S. nuclear command and control and warning systems. Okay, maybe that could happen, and that's an entirely different scenario. It wouldn't happen deliberately, but it would happen as the accidental byproduct of some Russian penetration, and the Russians, of course, would have said beforehand, no, we're not going to make that mistake. That's not going to happen. But, of course, it might.
A big part of the story here is the role of kind of perception and misperception in cyberspace. And to illustrate that, you share this really lovely anecdote in the book about the fallout that Intel faced in the early 90s after it shipped a processor with a known vulnerability. Can you talk a little bit about that story and what it tells us about some of the risks and vulnerabilities we should expect to see in a more computer dependent NC3?
The Intel FDIV bug was a problem in one of their processors. What happened was that in a particular operation, FDIV, floating point divide, there was a problem in it that on occasion would give you the wrong answer. Okay, if you executed this operation, it would give you the wrong answer. So, you know, 2 divided by 1 would give you 1.999999996 or something like that. It wouldn't give you 2, right, which is what it's supposed to do. And there was a bug in it. And first of all, Intel took a long time to acknowledge the bug. Never mind that. There's a lot of proof, and it took them a long time. Okay, fine. They wanted to confirm it themselves and so on. You can understand that. But then their response to it was, no, this will appear, you know, this will happen only once in 27 million years or whatever, some large number, okay? This happens very rarely, very, very rarely. And it's not worth fixing for most people. But people said, wait a minute, you mean I have to, you know, even if this is true, I mean, I still want a system that works, that I know works properly. And then they said, no, we'll give it to people who can prove that they're going to be affected by it. And eventually it became a whole PR debacle for them. And they finally gave up and replaced every single one of those chips. And they wrote off $500 million for it. Now, I have every reason to believe that their engineering analysis was right, that this would only happen very, very rarely. The problem would only happen rarely, okay? But people weren't satisfied with that. They wanted a system that they had confidence in that would work. So it was the difference between, you know, your computer, your calculator mostly works, and your calculator always works. And, you know, for all practical purposes, mostly is good enough. But that destroys confidence. And so people said, we're not going to deal with that. And so, you know, ultimately Intel bit the bullet and said, well, okay, fine. And it was a very costly mistake for them because they underestimated the role of confidence. It would have cost them the same amount of money, but they would have gotten a lot better. Their reputation would not have taken such a big hit. So,
when it comes to defense technology and acquisition, there's been a lot of talk about kind of this paradigm shift over the last few decades, where technology innovation has moved outside the government and into the private sector. And in response, there's been a bunch of people both within and outside the government who've been pushing for the DoD, for example, to kind of learn the lessons of Silicon Valley in their approach to software development, technology acquisition, etc. Can you talk about kind of the promise and pitfalls for the DoD when it comes to looking at Silicon Valley as kind of the guiding light for those types of things, especially when we're talking about nuclear weapons?
Sure. Very much so. So, if you listen to the rhetoric of the Department of Defense here, they say we need to have we need to build software and so on the way Silicon Valley builds software. Okay, why do they want to do that? Well, they observe that Silicon Valley has made huge amounts of money deploying software in the Silicon Valley way, and they regard that as successful. And of course, by Silicon Valley metrics, that is successful, right? Because they have the business of Silicon Valley is to make money, and they have made, you know, Amazon has made huge fortunes, and you know, Uber and DoorDash and so on are very popular. Okay. And people use their software. They use their products a lot, and they pay a lot of attention to usability and functionality and so on. All things that you want in any new computer systems that you might want to deploy. So this is all very good. But there is a key point about Silicon Valley software, which is that it is, you know, when it's been successful. You know when a software deployment has been successful because people like using it and they use it more and they make money on the platform. Okay. If there is functionality that doesn't work or something is hard to use or so on, they suffer from it. There's ultimately a metric for determining whether or not the products are successful. There is no similar metric for example, for nuclear command and control. Who are the users there? In the Silicon Valley environment, the users are the customer. It's me. Okay. I want my DoorDash delivery to happen at 3 p.m. And if it delivers at 3 a.m., I'm going to be really mad. Okay. I'm the ultimate judge of what's appropriate there. But in a nuclear command and control system, or any military system for that matter, there are some decisions that are properly made at the level of the operator, the guy, the person sitting at the, you know, at the keyboard, or the person in the airplane or something like that. Okay. And so there are some ways in which Silicon Valley software production techniques are really useful for that person. That person can say, well, you know, I can't see the display because it's the colors are bad or something like that. So you change the colors. And the old way of doing Silicon Valley, the old way of acquisition software, it would take you a year to fix that problem. And the Silicon Valley environment, it'll take you 3 weeks to fix the problem. So that's good. Okay. And maybe that display is on a nuclear bomber. And that's still good. All right. But there are other things which aren't so good in that environment. So, for example, you can imagine a pilot saying, you know, you mean the system is telling me that I need to get authorization to hit that target? Well, yeah, it is telling you that. And it's not clear to me at that point that the user, that the operator, that is the pilot, should have the authority necessarily to drop a nuclear weapon where this pilot sees an interesting target, right? You want that authority to be centralized. You want that authority to come down from the highest ranks of command. That's a good thing, not a bad thing. But you could easily imagine a pilot saying, this is inconvenient. It's gonna, you know, the target's gonna disappear if I don't get something there quickly or something like that. You could imagine that. You could certainly imagine a pilot being concerned about that. But in that situation, no, you want the system to enforce a requirement that the pilot gets proper authorization. And that's not the kind of environment that the Silicon Valley software is designed to optimize. Okay. And put differently, there's one customer one perspective that ultimately matters to DoorDash, okay, and that's me, the customer. there are many other users of a command. There are many different users, kinds of users in the command system. You know, the pilot, the people who formulate the orders, the person who gives the orders, and so on. All of those things, their needs all have to be, you know, taken into account. And in that kind of environment, when you have ambiguous metrics of effectiveness and so on, it's much harder to use Silicon Valley's techniques.
I promised I would bring us back to the imperatives that flow from your research. This is a book, I think you talk a little bit about it, is being kind of directed towards policymakers as we're undergoing this nuclear modernization plans. And without taking an unfair shot at them, you know, the caricature of the policymaker is kind of big on ego, short on attention. So if you had to, you know, give kind of the one, two, or three most important imperatives, you know, you only had 30 seconds with somebody, what would those be?
The first one, from my point of view, is that, I mean, the high level observation is that more complexity means more cyber risk, which means that you want to reduce complexity wherever you can. One very important way of reducing complexity is to reduce the amount of conventional nuclear integration that you're trying to do, rather than increasing it. That conventional nuclear integration is a very complicated problem, and it's going to put a lot more stress on your nuclear command and control than a system that's designed primarily for nuclear. So that will reduce the risk of inadvertent escalation. A corollary to that is that we are, in our efforts to do in integration, there is a worry that I have that the needs of the conventional side, the conventional forces, are going to be given top priority because they're the ones that are most likely to be used. And I think I argue the opposite. I think that the needs of the nuclear side ought to be given priority because they're the most important. They're the most catastrophic. They're the place where I want things to, where I want to make sure that things don't go wrong. I can tolerate errors in or problems in the conventional side that I cannot tolerate on the nuclear side, simply because nuclear weapons have the existential, you know, catastrophic potential. I'll give two others. The next one is that you want to keep the legacy system around for much longer than you would want to if it were an ordinary system. That is, you know, the old system works. And that means that that's a good error check. So you can't do the error check unless it's still existing. You can't use it for error checking unless it's still existing. So you want to, and you want to be able to keep the old system around to provide a check on the new system as it gets deployed. Okay, that's going to be controversial. A lot of people are not going to like that recommendation because it'll say it'll cost too much and so on. Well, okay, but you know, to me, the security of the system security is worth a lot. And I think that the last one on this is that somebody has to be willing to make trade-offs between reducing cyber risk and increasing performance. And that has to be faced squarely. Performance and functionality can't be given the priority all the time. Somebody has to be willing to say no to that, and that's going to be very hard because of course, people always want more functionality. So I think those are the things that I would emphasize.
So let me leave you with one final question. You did kind of this yeoman's work of looking at this problem in a systematic and very detailed and concrete way. Is the net result of that process leave you optimistic that we're going to have the political will to kind of nudge this problem in the direct direction over time? Or are you concerned that any number of obstacles are going to stand in the way and we're kind of going to go in this direction that will create more risk in this system as opposed to less or at least an equivalent degree of risk to the system we have now?
All historical experience, both with DOD and others, suggests that my worst fears are going to be realized. That's why I wanted to get this thing out as soon as I could. I'm an individual shouting in the wilderness here. The caricature of what I said is Lynn is anti-innovation. Right. I mean, that would be the bumper slogan. There's a grain of truth to it. OK, it's not exactly correct, but I'm saying, yeah, sometimes you want to you have to sacrifice innovation to get better security. And it's worth the trade off. Yes, that is what I'm saying. And that's not, as I say, that's not a popular message. So, but then again, I've tilted at windmills for a long time. So on this point, I mean, this issue is not just limited to the Department of Defense and nuclear matters. I mean, this is endemic to society, in which we always want more from our computer systems. So,
well, anti-innovation and possibly anti-cats may not be the best slogan for your presidential campaign. I'm referencing a lovely op-ed that Dr. Lynn had in the, I believe, the LA Times recently. I encourage everybody to read the op-ed, to read the book, which is Cyber Threats and Nuclear Weapons. Dr. Lynn, thank you for coming on the podcast and best of luck with the book and future research.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.